Morning, everybody. On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Maryland Morning. One in four residents of Baltimore lives in a food desert without easy access to healthy eating options. Holly Freistadt from the City Food Policy Office and Robert Thomas, who oversees Baltimore's public markets, tells us what the city is doing to solve the problem of food insecurity. Then Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders will be in Milwaukee on Thursday night to face off in their seventh debate. James Blue is producing this event for the PBS NewsHour. He'll give us the inside scoop about all that goes on before the candidates take the stage. Then when Diana Nyad swam from Cuba to Florida in 2013, she inspired millions with her tenacity and determination. She's speaking at the Meyerhoff tomorrow night. She speaks with us this morning. And theater critic J. Wynn Russick has a review of Under the Skin at the Everyman Theater. First, the news.
I'm producer Kathleen Cahill. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, and 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Thanks, Nathan. Appreciate it. Good morning, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. So, Nathan, did you watch the game last night?
No.
You did not. Do you own a television, Nathan?
Yes, I do, but I have other things that I'd rather watch.
There you go. All right. Well, I'll have you give our listeners an update on that, because, you know, we do know you've been reporting who won the game, and we appreciate that, you know, on behalf of a grateful nation. We are going to talk about something very serious this morning. If you're at one of those Super Bowl parties and ate too much, think about this sobering fact. Here in Baltimore, we're a city of about 620,000 people, but one of every four of us lives in a food desert. That's shorthand for a low-income neighborhood, almost 30 of them across our city, where grocery stores are scarce, where transportation options are limited, and many people can't afford a car to get them to stores with fresh, wholesome food. And the racial disparities are glaring. 34% of the city's African-American residents live in food desert neighborhoods, compared to only 8% of white residents. So last week, I talked about food deserts with the Reverend Dr. Heber Brown. He's the pastor of Pleasant Hope Baptist Church in North Baltimore. He described his efforts to organize the Black Church Food Security Network to sell food grown by local black farmers directly to city residents by way of a church-sponsored market or food stalls at church locations. Several other grassroots and religious organizations are engaged in similar efforts. Well, this week, we want to explore what the city government is doing to address inequities in food access. Holly Freistadt is the city's food czar. She's the director of the Baltimore Food Policy Initiative. Robert Thomas is the executive director of the Lexington Market. Since December of 2014, he's been the head of the Baltimore Public Markets Corporation. That's the city agency that runs all of the historic food markets around the city. And they both join me in the studio. Good morning. Good to see you.
Good morning.
So, Holly, give us an update on the status of tax incentives for supermarkets. This is a relatively new proposal that the mayor introduced, I don't know, 4 or 6 weeks ago, something like that. The idea is to, you know, give incentives to supermarkets to locate in Baltimore. Where does that stand?
Sure. So the good news is that it was enacted on January 31st, so it's gone into effect. And this is a part of a big strategy of the city, the Food Desert Retail Strategy. And one of them is to attract and maintain grocery stores. And we know that policy is necessary to do so. So this personal property tax credit is for bringing new stores into the city, but also for expansion or renovations of existing stores. So we want to keep the stores we have in the city. We want them to renovate, improve their healthy food availability, and also to bring new stores in.
So one of the things it does is it takes away or attenuates in some way the tax on, like, the freezers they have in the stores and the equipment they have. How does that work, and why is it being approached that way rather than straight property tax relief?
So several years ago, we asked all the retailers what would be the big wins for them to help them have stores in the city. And they all said personal property tax. So for grocery stores, personal property is a huge expense for them. It's everything you can shake out of the store, which is a lot. And for most of the city, there's already many incentives in place through the Baltimore Development Corporation for real property. So it's personal property that they were really missing any of the tax incentives.
So, Robert Thomas, you head up the Lexington Market as well as the consortium of folks who run all of the markets. There's also a proposal, a report just issued recently, calls for about a $27 million renovation of Lexington Market. What chances do you give that idea?
Well, better than 50%, let's say. Mm-hmm. But at this point, the idea is that we actually have to do it. And we have to do that for, we have to redevelop each of the public markets because each of them has to respond more effectively to the neighborhoods wherein we find ourselves. Lexington happens to be a crossroads, and so it's a mixture of neighborhoods. But we have to prepare ourselves going into this part of the 21st century to meet a more diverse population and meet the food needs at the same time, the whole socioeconomic scale. That's available in Baltimore. We need to provide that.
The mayor is suggesting this is a good idea to take the report recommendations and spend $27 million. Excuse me, but she's not saying where the $27 million come from.
Right.
So where do they come from?
The capital stack is going to be public money as well as foundational money from philanthropy and private corporations as well as a capital campaign. So we're still in the money hunt. But we have to assemble all of those pieces to make this work.
This is part Holly Freistadt. This the business of the markets and the business of attracting supermarkets is all part of a comprehensive strategy. One of the key dimensions of that strategy is transportation. Transportation is a real issue. Food deserts are defined as being more than a quarter of a mile away from a grocery store. If you bought groceries, you've got two bags full to walk, and you've got to walk more than a quarter of a mile. That's a trek, and that's tough to do. Of course, you know, we've got the red line controversy. The governor has, put the kibosh on that. How does your office and how does the mayor approach the issue of transportation and simply getting people to be at the Lexington Market or a ShopRite, in their neighborhood?
So in your definition of food desert, you're absolutely right. Quarter mile is one part. Another part of the definition is low vehicle availability. So we've always known that transportation is a significant issue. And in our food desert retail strategy, one of the strategies is to develop out a food access transportation strategy. And so Baltimore Link is the first part of that. We have the Food Policy Advisory Committee. It's 50 organizations plus. We have been meeting every 6 weeks to analyze Baltimore Link. We've been working with the state and making sure that we look at how does Baltimore Link affect those who are using the bus system, which we know many are, to get to supermarkets for shopping, but also for jobs. They need to get to work, and we need to make sure that the transportation strategies allow for people to get to work and to be able to buy their food. And so we've been working on this pretty consistently now.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. That's Holly Freistadt. She's the city's food czar. She directs the Baltimore Food Policy Initiative. Robert Thomas is the executive director of the Lexington Market and the consortium of folks who run all of the Baltimore public markets. You're laughing, Holly, when I mention you as the food czar, but that is what you're concentrating on, right?
So I've been trying to shake that name for 6 years, and I can't, so I embrace it. And so the reason I'm the food policy director, I do a lot of policy strategic planning, building of networks and consortiums and working with many partners. Food czar implies that I'm telling people what to eat, which I'm not. But we want to make sure that people get access to healthy, affordable food.
But in a way, Holly is telling us where to eat, saying, we've got to get grocery stores in neighborhoods that don't have them, and we've got to make the markets more accessible. One of the big problems with Lexington Market and all of the public markets is there's a perception that they're not safe. I mean, there have been, more than 250 arrests last year near Lexington Market, many of them related to drugs. I mean, people are just reluctant to go there because they think they're walking into trouble. How are you addressing that, and how can you and the vendors at Lexington Market address that?
Once people get inside each of the markets, there really is a low-risk sense of things, and it's a low-risk reality. The perception, of course, that we've dealt with is that you can't get there from here, or at least you can't get there safely. That's why we have started collaborations with BPD. Well, we've begun that a long time ago, but other stakeholders as well, to just get the area around the markets, plural, conducive to business.
What about even before any renovation would happen? Because obviously $26, $27 million is going to take a long time to figure out where that's going to come from. So in the shorter term, right now, more than half of the vendors at Lexington Market are selling what most folks would identify as unhealthy food. I mean, these are prepared food things. They're not fresh produce stands. They're not fresh meat and fresh fish. Is there a way to tip the balance of the quality of food, the healthfulness of the food that's available in these markets in the short term before any renovations are done?
We believe so, and we believe that that's necessary so that, in fact, if the structure is a structure, but getting the interior experience to be both beneficial to the community as well as effective for us. It's something that we have to do with the balance of shifting the composition of markets and the composition of food offerings as well as the tenant mix. So that means some get retained, some get relocated.
What's a normal lease for a vendor at the Lexington Market?
At this point, given the plans that are in afoot a year,
mm-hmm.
yeah, it's typical.
So you would have some flexibility to not renew the lease of a vendor whose products you thought maybe weren't in the best interest of the market.
That's
overall.
Correct. Or if we had a tremendous replication elsewhere throughout the market.
Mm-hmm. And Holly Freistadt, another aspect of what you all are working on is the SNAP benefits. This is just a sort of bureaucratic solution because the benefits are only in effect, as I understand them, and this is subsidized benefits for people of low income. They're only in effect like the first few days of the month or something. Explain how that works.
Let me explain. So SNAP, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, otherwise known as food stamps, it's a federally funded, and then it comes through to residents in Baltimore and all over the country. So there's two things I wanted to mention. One is SNAP disbursement. It used to be, so say in August or last year, all the disbursement would come in a 10-day period. So everyone would get their SNAP benefits, but most of the time everyone would spend it pretty fast. And so within 14 days, everyone was in and out of the grocery store, and then the grocery stores were really slow for the rest of the month. Very hard for operations, very hard for employment, lots of people in the beginning of the month, very slow at the end of the month. We really want to attract and retain grocery stores. So by changing it over to 20 days, we can have the stores have people in it more often.
Mm-hmm. And Robert Thomas, there's a idea called virtual markets, people yes. shopping online. If there's a scarcity of grocery stores, isn't there also a scarcity of broadband access? How does that work where people go on their computers? Or is that something that Holly really knows more about?
So the health department has the Baltimore Market program, and the yes. virtual supermarket has expanded to 6 sites in senior disabled housing. They partner with ShopRite. They have 21 neighborhood food advocates who live in those senior housing, and they buy online, and once a week, they pick up their orders, and they can use their SNAP benefits at the time of pickup.
Yeah, and so they can get them close to where they live. Yeah.
So they're only in food deserts.
Yeah. All right, well, that's all the time we have. I appreciate you guys coming by. We're going to stick with this and talk to you again about the progress you guys are making. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Holly Freistadt's the director of Baltimore's Food Policy Initiative. Robert Thomas is the executive director of the Baltimore Public Markets Corporation, runs the city's 6 historic food markets. On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall. Coming up, a look behind the scenes at this Thursday's Democratic presidential debate. Stay with us.
Join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Hillary Clinton inched out a razor-thin victory in Iowa last week. Tomorrow night, we'll see if Senator Bernie Sanders can parlay his New England connection into a victory in the New Hampshire primary. It's widely assumed that he will. And on Thursday night, the two contenders will meet in Milwaukee for their 7th debate of this primary season. It will be the first without former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley, who suspended his campaign after a meager showing in Iowa. My next guest this morning is James Blue, who is the senior content and special projects producer at the PBS NewsHour. He is producing this debate, which will be moderated by Gwen Ifill and Judy Woodruff. He joins me on the line from Milwaukee. Good morning, James. Good to talk to you.
Good morning, Tom.
So, first of all, tell me, who decides which media outlet gets what debate? I mean, when Fox had that early debate, the famous debate in which Megyn Kelly alienated Mr. Trump. It was one of the largest audiences for a cable news television program in the history of the business. It's a huge windfall for some of these networks. I mean, PBS works on a different business model, but who actually decides who gets what debate on what night?
Well, you know, Tom, what happens this cycle, there was a lot of concern during the 2012 campaign that there were potentially too many debates. And so both parties, the GOP and the Democratic Party, decided to take over the debates and invited all of the networks, all comers, to apply to become a debate partner. And so our debate is a fully sanctioned debate that is being run, that is being put on by PBS NewsHour with the approval and with the sanction of the DNC. Just one note, we were to be the first debate between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders after the Iowa caucuses. But you may remember last week, MSNBC, at the very last moment, pitched a debate just after Governor O'Malley dropped out. So NBC went to the candidates. The candidates agreed. It was a big sort of mess. And then finally, the Democrats conceded. And as you may know, over the weekend, they've announced that they've added additional debates in March and April, including one in Flint, Michigan. But the idea was to try to control the message and to try to control the way in which the candidates are put on display to the American public.
And when the MSNBC debate idea came up, when they pitched that, did you all have any part of that discussion? I mean, were you were sort of disenfranchised in a way. All of a sudden you became not the first debate after Iowa. Did you have any say in that matter?
You know, what say can we have? I think, you know, debates are good for the American public. The race was heating is heating up and is quite close. And I think, you know, given the spirit of what we do at public broadcasting, more debates is a good thing. Would we have preferred to be the first debate after voting in Iowa and New Hampshire? Of course. But we are now the first debate after votes are cast in the nation's first primary. And I think, you know, given the attention of the race and sort of where it is going, I think we're going to have a very good debate.
So have you then been negotiating with the two campaigns, the Sanders and the Clinton campaigns, about the logistics and the, you know, the specifics of what's going to happen on the stage on Thursday night? And if so, what's the tone of those negotiations been?
You know, the tone has been absolutely friendly, cordial. The candidates and the campaigns recognize this is an opportunity for them to speak to the American people, a real opportunity to sort of lay out their plans for our country's future. And it really has been, you know, given the spirit of public broadcasting, where we really enjoy conversation, we want to give people the chance not only to answer questions, but perhaps to share an idea. I think that premise and that model has really helped, and the campaigns have been very eager and interested in sort of following the suggestions that we've made. We're going to have a slightly longer debate, 95 minutes of questioning. There will be opening statements and closing statements. But we really wanted to focus on giving the candidates the ability to sort of say what it is they want to say, with follow-ups, with redirection by our anchors, Gwen Ifill and Judy Woodruff, but really a chance to try to get to some of the real matters that are important to the future of this country.
James Blue is a senior producer for the PBS NewsHour. He's in charge of getting the show on the road Thursday night in Milwaukee when Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton face off in the first debate after the New Hampshire primary. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. So, James, can you give us some gossip? I mean, the specific things that they negotiate. Is there like, you know, some 40-page rider in, you know, Bernie Sanders' contract that says he's got to have just purple Skittles in his dressing room and stuff like that? Anything that can, you know.
It's very interesting that this question comes up a lot. And there haven't been demands of anything like that. One of the candidates prefers tea in the green room. And so, of course, we can get tea. I mean, one of the things that recently came up, and I hadn't thought of this, we have asked, as other debates have, that the candidates not have their campaign staffs backstage. Now, I didn't recognize the importance of that until about last week, when if they did have their campaign aides backstage, they could continue to do prep and that type of thing. And so we have, I think, done exactly what the other campaigns have done, and the other networks have done, really just trying to create a comfortable platform for them to talk and speak directly to the American people. Of course, we're going to ask hard questions. We're going to ask challenging questions. We have a partnership with Facebook. We think one of the first for our debate is that we're going to ask three questions from groups of voters in South Carolina and Nevada. Those are the next two primary states. And we're going to include three questions from that group. And it's very possible that we're going to include a question as a follow-up from the group that will happen during the course of the evening. We're not showing videos. We're not playing recordings. Gwen Ifill and Judy Woodruff will ask the questions directly themselves, but they will have been solicited from our Facebook group page. And if you go to PBS NewsHour on Facebook, you might be able to be a part of it.
So just for the record, which candidate prefers tea?
Oh, you'll never get that out of me.
There you go. All right. Stonewalling me on the tea question. Of course, because the real issue is that the other candidate prefers gin. Is that what you're saying?
All right. Oh, my gosh.
How about the fact that Governor O'Malley has dropped out of the race? Now you've got a two-person debate as opposed to a three-person debate. In terms of your agenda here, which is to make it as riveting as possible as a piece of television, does that increase your chances, or were you a little sad to see the governor drop out?
Well, you know, first of all, Tom, if you'd like a podium, I can certainly sell you one really, really cheaply, because we did have to plan on three candidates. Look, I think Governor O'Malley certainly had some ideas. Unfortunately, they were not making any traction in Iowa or nationally. And I think if you did see the debate between Secretary Clinton and Senator Sanders on last Thursday on MSNBC, they both came prepared to fight.
They're lighting it up, aren't they? Yeah.
They were lighting it up. And, you know, the hope is they will continue to feel that way. You may have heard that they've sort of done a recount or a readjustment in Iowa. And so the win that Hillary Clinton had, it was much smaller than it was originally expected. Bernie Sanders is expected to win in New Hampshire. And so this debate really is potentially a chance for Secretary Clinton to really state the case, having come off a tie, basically, and a what looks like a loss. How is it that she is the person who the Democratic Party should choose as their candidate? I think, you know, she really has to make an argument given where she is, you know, politically.
How did Gwen Ifill and Judy Woodruff prepare for this event? How many folks they have working with them? And are they taking, and are you taking as the producer, any particular debate so far in this primary season as the paradigm, as the thing that that you hope to equal or better?
Well, look, I think we just want to provide a good conversation for the viewers out there. And there is a whole team that's working on questions and with Gwen and Judy. The great thing about Gwen and Judy is that we know they are phenomenal journalists. Every night, the hallmark of PBS NewsHour is to ask interesting, enlightening questions. And so this is part of our DNA. Yes, this is a sort of more important venue for that practice, but it's something that we're very skilled at and something that we are very comfortable with doing. And so the same teams that prepare them night after night are preparing them for this debate. And I'm very confident in terms of where we are in our prep for the really good conversation between our anchors, the candidates, and the American public.
You've worked on both sides of the pond in television. You were a producer for Ted Koppel at Nightline for a number of years. You were at ABC. Is there a demonstrable difference between the approach to a project like this on the PBS side than there would be from the commercial television side?
You know, that's a very good question. And in truth, there is, and it has everything to do with commercials. We don't do commercials. And one of the challenges, and in the past debates, the candidates have been accustomed to having more breaks during the course of the conversation. And so one of the things we've had to say to them, we don't have the luxury or the option of going away, selling, you know, millions of dollars of ads and then coming back. I think what that does is concentrate the conversations. So we have to stay inside the debate hall, stay focused on these periods of questioning that I think will really make a difference. And I think this will be a very significant difference between our debate and debates in other places.
And as a practical matter, that means that neither of the candidates get to take a restroom break during the 95 minutes of this program?
Well, we are going to have one break in the middle, which will allow them to do that. And as you know, the bathroom breaks have become a bit of a joke during some of these debates. And I can assure you, the bathrooms for both candidates are adjacent to the stage.
All right. And the same color and the same size and the same everything, right? Yeah, of course. what are you, there's a lot of talk about the DNC and its apparent effort to sort of make sure that the debate schedule was tilted in favor of Mrs. Clinton. As you mentioned, several debates now have been added to the schedule. And a lot of folks say, you know, why wasn't she willing to do these debates from the very beginning? Because she's such a good debater. She often comes off very, very well. What's your feeling about the number and the timing? You know, some of these Democratic debates have, you know, taken place in a cave in North Dakota at 11 o'clock on a Saturday night and that kind of thing. I mean, Where do you stand when it comes to the accessibility of Mrs. Clinton in particular for debates?
Well, I think I can only comment on what PBS does. And PBS has decided to put this debate on in prime time Thursday night at 9. In addition, we're going to be streaming on all the NPR stations across the country. In addition, the debate will be simulcast on CNN, both domestically, internationally, on CNN in Spanish. So I can say that we really consider this to be a public service, and we're happy to share our programming and our debate with anyone. You know, the fact that some networks have chosen to run debates in the weekend, in Christmas time, you know, that may work for their model. We know that we wanted to put a debate on in prime time, and that's what we've been able to do. Right. And through our partners, yeah, we've been able to share it with everyone.
Well, James, break a leg on Thursday night. We appreciate your time this morning, and we look forward to watching.
Thank you so much.
James Blue is the senior content and special projects producer at the PBS NewsHour. He's the producer of the debate on Thursday night between Democratic presidential contenders Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. It will air on PBS and right here on WIPR live from Milwaukee, 9 o'clock Thursday night. WIPR will also carry NPR's live coverage of the New Hampshire primary tomorrow night beginning at 8 o'clock. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Lots more coming up. Stick around. The Everyman Theater in Baltimore is presenting a new play called Under the Skin. Our theater critic, Jay Wynn Russick, has checked it out, and she brings us this review.
Several times in Under the Skin, a bell goes off on one of the character's cell phones. Whenever it does, the character closes her eyes and breathes deeply. What is this? Here's how she explains it.
It's an app that rings at random times of day to remind me to be mindful.
Of what?
I don't know. Breathing. Just being alive. My yoga teacher suggested it. She said it would help me be more conscious.
Being mindful, aware, in the moment, is something that trips up these characters, beautifully played at Everyman Theater by Megan Anderson and Keith L. Royal Smith. There are too many stumbling blocks in their past, and one very big decision looming in their future. Megan Anderson's character, Raina, is the estranged daughter of a man who shows up on her doorstep, unexpected, unannounced, and in stage 5 renal failure. He needs a kidney, quite possibly hers. A play about a kidney transplant might sound like a movie of the week tearjerker, but playwright Michael Hollinger is too much of a theater craftsman for that. He's written a script full of theatrical devices, revelations, and even humor, all skillfully conveyed by director Vincent M. Lanchese. One of Hollinger's cleverest devices is the way he uses direct audience address. Characters speak directly to the audience at various points throughout the play, beginning in the second scene, right after Raina's father, Lou, has told her he's a candidate for a kidney transplant. Instead of just monologues, these direct address passages often include interruptions by other characters.
This story is not about kidneys.
Sure it is.
No, it isn't.
It kinda is.
It's about another kind of organ. It's about the human heart, okay? The boundaries of the body and the limits of love.
Sections like this don't just didactically spell out the play's themes. They also disarm the audience. And those themes are indeed broader than organ transplants, though that's certainly a weighty issue and a personal one for every man. The theater's resident lighting designer, J.A. Herzog, underwent a liver transplant just a year ago. Relationships between parents and children are also central to Under the Skin. Will Raina get over her deep-seated resentment of her father enough to consider being his donor? Mitchell Hebert gives an appropriately gruff portrayal of this distant dad. Raina gets encouragement from Keith Royal Smith's character, Jarell. Jarell strikes up a conversation with Raina in a coffee shop. He's hoping to donate a kidney to a close family friend. The two feel a bond that turns out to be something deeper than either imagined. At this point, Under the Skin threatens to morph into Greek tragedy. Later, in a scene with Raina and Jarell in Lou's hospital room, their interaction verges on farce. As the jolt from near tragedy to broad farce suggests, Under the Skin is trying to be and do too much. Add some dark past revelations by Jarell's mother, played with great warmth by Alice M. Gatling, and Under the Skin goes over the top. For example, the play's climactic 11th-hour revelation by Lou's doctor is so obvious that at the performance I attended, an audience member called it out before the doctor could say it. Every Man's production is only the second time Under the Skin has been staged. Playwright Hollinger has made revisions since the play debuted in Philadelphia last year. And director Lancisi and his fine cast deliver a carefully wrought, sensitive production. However, that very sensitivity makes the instances of overstatement stand out all the more. With further fine-tuning, this intriguing look at an important issue, rarely seen on stage, just might touch the heart.
I've got you under my skin.
Under the Skin is at the Everyman Theater in Baltimore until February 21st. We've got a link with all the details on our website, wypr.org/Marilyn Morning. Next week, theater critic Jay Wynn Russick returns with a review of the latest offering at Arena Stage in Washington. After the news, I'll be back for a conversation with Diana Nyad. 3 years ago, at the age of 64, she swam 111 miles from Cuba to Florida. Don't try this at home. It's Marilyn Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
I've said to myself, this affair, it never will go so well. But why should I try to resist when, baby, I know damn well that I've got you under my skin.
Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We are at Marilyn Morning. Now, back to the show.
My next guest this morning is Diana Nyad. In 2013, she became the first person ever to swim from Cuba to Florida without a shark cage. She completed the 111-mile trek after four unsuccessful attempts dating back to the 1970s. She was 64 years old when she accomplished this amazing feat. She will be at the Joseph Meyerhoff Symphony Hall in Baltimore tomorrow night to speak on the Baltimore Speaker Series hosted by Stevenson University. She joins me this morning on the phone from Los Angeles. Ms. Nyad, it's a pleasure to talk to you. How you doing?
Tom, my pleasure. I can't wait to be with everybody in Baltimore.
Yeah, well, we're looking forward to having you here. You started researching this idea of swimming from Cuba to Florida back in 1977. Other people had done long-distance swims, like, you know, the English Channel and stuff. But what was the particular appeal? This particular swim, Cuba to Florida, seems to have been a kind of holy grail for you. How come?
It has long been called the Cuba Stretch, the Mount Everest of the Earth's oceans. You and I could lay out all the nautical charts of this blue jewel planet of ours, and we couldn't find Mother Nature raging on steroids in terms of what a swimmer comes up against any harder, any more furiously around the globe than it does in that stretch of the Florida Straits between Cuba and Florida. It's the, of course, it's the sheer distance, but it's the particular animals that live there, that particular deadly box jellyfish, the particular species of sharks, quick, aggressive, the oceanic white tip. It's the current, the Gulf Stream that's going east. It's dragging you fast, east, 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 and you're trying to swim north, north, north. Then you've got an east wind that's coming over from Africa going up against that current. You know, I could go on for hours. It's like, it's just, it's a highly unlikely scenario to get across. Then you add that forbidden land, Cuba, that magical island that was just so close you could almost touch it from the Florida shore where I grew up. So it all sort of, you know, circled around to make a story, a dramatic story. And that's what most mountain climbers and, you know, cross-country trekkers look for. They're looking for the imagination of a place on Earth that would be exciting, that would be thrilling to try to cross. And that was always Cuba for me.
You know, I'm struck by, in your book, Find a Way, you talk, of course, about the, you know, the incredible physical tenacity and determination that it takes and the pain that you had to endure and the terrific team that you have. But you also talk about the beauty, the wonder of the experience itself, swimming in that particular part of the ocean. And you're right at one point, you say it's a, and you did this, of course, when you were 64 years old, you say it's a very different time of our life, our 60s, compared to our 20s. The ego's not so fragile, the peacock feather's not so driven to strut. And add to that the realization that I swam many of those hours back in my 20s in utter rage. This time I was in love with our blue planet, whereas I barely noticed her when I was young. This was a very spiritual experience for you, wasn't it?
Yeah, I guess you could go, so I want to be careful, you know, not to say religious. I'm not a religious person, but spiritual, you know, you're right about age. I mean, you know, when I was in my 20s, it doesn't mean that I couldn't, you know, stand on a beautiful beach and look out at a sunset and see that it was beautiful. But wow, when you get closer toward the end of this one-week, you know, way street, we're all traveling, you just take a deep breath at the stunning beauty that the Earth is. And to be a good traveler, you know, you could look at it that way. We would train. I'd swim from St. Martin over to the island of Anguilla. You know, most people take a boat and they make that an all-day excursion. I'd swim over there, take a turn and swim all the way back to the island of St. Martin, swim along the Florida coast for miles and miles and miles traveling. You almost have the, you know, unreal sensation that you're traveling over the curvature of the Earth. So it is a sport of suffering. I think that if you talk to most extreme alpine climbers, you know, if you've seen any of the films of Everest and Annapurna and K2, there's a lot of suffering up at high altitude. And then on the other hand, every now and then, because they got in good enough shape, because they had the science and the technology and the teamwork, they get a moment of utter awe standing on the top of, or you know, in the middle of those couloirs that you just can't get sitting around on the couch. And the same for me out in that beautiful ocean where no one had ever gone, you know, traversing a very difficult stretch. It's tough, it's tough, it's tough. And then occasionally you float on your back and you look up at 4 billion stars out in the middle of nowhere, and you got there on your own steam. I tell you, Tom, it's a natural high like I've never known.
On 88.1, my guest this morning, Diana Nyad, the long-distance swimmer, the broadcaster, the author, the linguist, a person of many talents. She'll be appearing at the speaker series sponsored by Stevenson University tomorrow night. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. I'm also struck, Ms. Nyad, by the fact that you titled your book Find a Way. There's a lot about not giving up and that incredible determination that it took for you to accomplish this. But part of not giving up was, in fact, finding the way. So it's not just a matter of physical tenacity, but also intellectual mastery of what it took to do this with your team.
Oh, yeah. This is a true full-on expedition. There were 44 people on the team in total, actually 17 on the inner circle. But we're talking about the top jellyfish expert in the world, Dr. Angel Yanagihara. We're talking about a mathematical genius of a navigator, John Bartlett. My head trainer, Bonnie, knows where courage lies. And if I'm fresh out, she knows how to summon that last drop that I might have in me. So, you know, I think that the point, though, Tom, is that it sounds like a story of an athlete, of an extreme adventurer and her team. And it is. It is all those things. But it is beyond that. The reason find a way was our mantra is because all of us, we're either battling a tough something, raising a disabled child, perhaps. We've got cancer. We're chasing a dream. You know, you're 65 years old, and you were going to be the writer of the great American novel, but you stuffed it in the back of a drawer 30 years ago. Everybody has another shore. Everybody has something they're looking at. We have hopes. We have dreams. And if you just don't give up, if you just, you get smashed, you get slapped down, you have to take curves, you have to be innovative. Well, if you want to get to that other shore of yours, you will find a way.
And with each successive try, because it's amazing that you tried this four times and were not successful, and it was the fifth attempt that finally worked, you write in your book that you were less confident each time you did it. For so many people, that fear would have been crippling. How you somehow turned it around. You made that fear work for you.
I think you're right. I was less confident, or let's say I was more overwhelmed and realistic about what is out there. Every time we stood on the shore in Cuba and looked out at that horizon, it looked farther and farther away because we knew too well what was out there. We had experienced it. It's not hyperbole to say I should have died with those massive box jellyfish things in 2011. It's almost always fatal, and I should have died that night. And so we stood there for the fifth time looking out saying, whoa. And Bonnie, my head handler, grabbed my shoulders, and that's where the phrase came. She said, come on, let's find a way. So, you could say maybe I was more realistic. I'm not sure if I'd use the words less confident, but I was more realistic about the slim chances to get across as we went. But I honestly, Tom, deep down, the resolve all those years was unshakable.
Diana Nyad, she'll be speaking at the Baltimore Speaker Series sponsored by Stevenson University tomorrow night. WIPR's Sheila Cast will host that event. We've got a link to more information on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. We look forward to your lecture tomorrow night, and thanks so much for your time this morning, Diana Nyad.
Tom, thank you very much.
Coming up Wednesday here on Maryland Morning, we'll continue our conversations with candidates for mayor of Baltimore City. State Senator Catherine Pugh will be my guest. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us. Garrison Keillor's up next with the Writer's Almanac. Have a great day.